Across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, October 2, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. It appears that the Republican-controlled Senate may have enough votes to push through the nomination of anti-civil rights and anti-abortion advocate Charles Pickering to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Turmoil in Pakistan over the recently released taped message of supposed al-Qaeda leader calling for the overthrow of President Musharraf. And the immigrant freedom rides are closing in on Capitol Hill. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Reproductive rights advocates lost on Capitol Hill today when the U.S. House approved a ban on the controversial late-term abortion procedure. Defenders of the procedure, also referred to as partial birth abortion, say it is sometimes the safest way to protect the health and fertility of a mother late in pregnancy. The White House is encouraging the Senate to move quickly on the measure, one that the president promises to sign. Advocates for reproductive freedom believe the ban is a way for anti-abortion activists to punch holes in the protections of Roe v. Wade. The U.S. Justice Department is preparing to send letters to employees in the Defense and State Departments regarding the leaked name of a CIA operative. Prosecutors have already sent a letter to White House staffers requiring them to hold on to any documents related to the matter. Reportedly, a Bush administration staff member contacted reporters saying that a former Ambassador Joseph Wilson's wife was a CIA agent after Wilson questioned the president's statement that Iraq was trying to buy uranium in Africa. And the United Nations Security Council today began discussing a revised U.S. draft resolution on Iraq. Susan Wood reports from the U.N.
The resolution is aimed at transforming the U.S.-led military occupation into a U.N.-mandated multinational force under U.S. command. U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte today sought to reassure allies that the issue is not whether, but how soon, self-rule will be restored to Iraqis.
We clarify this in the draft and reinforce the goal that all of us share, that the day when Iraqis govern themselves must come quickly.
But the initial response from Security Council members was tepid. Pakistan's ambassador said his nation would not wish to be associated with an occupation force, while Russia called for a clear timetable leading to a handover of power, which the draft text lacks. The U.S. says Iraqis must first draft a constitution and hold elections, which could take at least a year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Fuel prices have gone up by 20% in Nigeria following the deregulation of petroleum products. From Lagos, Sam Olakoya has more on the resulting troubles.
The implication of the deregulation is that Nigeria, the world's sixth largest oil producer, would export all its crude oil. On the other hand, private marketers would import refined oil for sale in the country at a high price. For several years now, financial institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have been pressurizing Nigeria to remove oil subsidies so that Nigerians can buy gasoline at the international rate. But Nigerians are opposed to the deregulation, saying that it will put them at the mercy of international oil marketers who would import gasoline and arbitrarily fix the price. The deregulation is coming barely 8 weeks after an earlier price increase. The union says it will disrupt the All African Games, which is scheduled to commence in Nigeria on Saturday. Mr. Adams Oshiomole, head of the labor union, says Nigerians cannot watch games when they are made to die piecemeal. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Today, senators declare that the FCC's drive to allow media conglomerates to control more stations and media outlets will curtail diversity at the local level. More from Capitol Hill, Jessamy Norton Ford.
At the hearing today, Senator McCain voiced concern about the FCC's changes in media ownership laws. His concerns particularly included the allowing of large media conglomerates to own not only a large TV network or radio station, but a newspaper as well. Senator John McCain, chairman of the Commerce Committee that called the hearing, said new FCC laws will threaten the diversity and localization of people's news. Senator Byron Drogan was also a part of calling today's hearing. He also expressed issue with the FCC's upcoming vote and spoke out by saying that the foundation of democracy includes a free flow of information and that the consolidation of media ownership would stifle such a right.
The highly concentrated industry in information is antithetical to the free flow of information, which I think is the foundation of democratic value.
President Bush has promised to veto any attempt to delay or change the new FCC ownership law. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Jessamy Norton Ford.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the CIA's David Kaye, who 2 months ago began the U.S. search for weapons of mass destruction, addressed Congress in a closed-door session. During the build-up to the invasion of Iraq, Kaye, a former U.N. weapons inspector, was adamant that Iraq had such weapons. But Kaye, in an interim report, is expected to show Congress that his 2-month search has not yielded any evidence that the weapons exist. Meanwhile, Republicans on the Senate Judicial Committee rejected a Democratic request that it should begin investigating the White House leak that revealed Ambassador Joseph Wilson's wife secretly worked for the CIA. Wilson and many Democrats contend the leak was in retaliation to Wilson's report that rebunked President Bush's claim that Saddam Hussein was seeking uranium from Niger, one of the main reasons cited for invading Iraq. The Senate Judicial Committee had another contentious debate today concerning Bush's judicial appointment of Charles Pickering to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Last year, a Democratic-controlled Senate rejected Pickering's nomination, as civil rights and pro-choice groups said as a federal judge in Mississippi, he was lenient to those who committed hate crimes, and as a state senator, supported outlawing abortion. But now a Republican-controlled Senate believes it may have enough votes to override a possible filibuster that could block the vote. Mitch Jeserich has more from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Judicial Committee passed the controversial judicial nomination of Charles Pickering for the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a young man at the University of Mississippi, Pickering wrote for a publication suggesting how Mississippi could maintain its law banning interracial marriage. He also had a strong connection to the pro-segregationist group, the Mississippi Sovereignty Committee. And as a judge, he sentenced a cross-burner to a penalty less than the minimal requirement under the law. He is now President Bush's pick to serve the second highest court in the country that has jurisdiction over Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah is the chair of the committee.
By many opponents, Charles Pickering is portrayed as the stereotype of the Southern white male, locked in the thought, culture, and traditions of his upbringing in the deep south of yesteryear. This is the caricature that they attack, but it is not the reality of who Judge Pickering is. Rather, Judge Pickering's action in the Swan case had everything to do with his penchant for going easy on first-time criminal defendants. Judge Pickering's record is replete with examples where he has seen the rehabilitative potential of first-time offenders and accordingly sentenced them to lighter sentences.
Last year, a Democratic-controlled Senate rejected the Pickering nomination. Now Democrats will try to filibuster it when it comes to the floor for a vote. It is uncertain, however, if the Democrats have the votes for such a maneuver because several Democratic senators from the South have indicated support for Pickering. Leslie Prohl is with the NAACP.
It signals that they are not getting the message that I think the Democrats are trying to send, which is send us moderate nominations. I mean, after Pickering was rejected the first time, somebody who is a uniter and not a divider would likely send somebody who was a consensus candidate from Mississippi, as some of the senators today have mentioned that that was a possibility. But instead, just weeks after the entire lot debacle, Bush really gives us the finger in the eye and goes ahead and renominates the judge.
Pro-choice advocates are dismayed as well. As a state senator in Mississippi, Pickering supported constitutionally banning abortion. Marcia Kuntz is with the Alliance for Justice.
Charles Pickering has an extensive record of insensitivity on issues of civil rights and on issues of choice, employment discrimination, environment. There's a whole host of issues that we have concerns about that we think render him unqualified for the bench. We think it's shameful that the president renominated him after he was rejected by the Judiciary Committee last year.
Bush nominations have been one of the most controversial items the Senate has dealt with over the last couple of years. On Wednesday, Senate Democrats walked away from a committee vote on the nomination of Mike Leavitt to head the EPA, delaying the vote for another 2 weeks. However, nominations aren't the only controversy right now in Congress. On Thursday, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York called on the Senate Judicial Committee to investigate the White House for leaking the identity of a CIA operative.
There are obviously all kinds of questions about whether the Justice Department can do this in an arm's length way. Today, in today's newspapers, it is documented that there is a nexus of connections between Attorney General Ashcroft and Karl Rove in the White House. Now, I don't know if Karl Rove was involved in this, but it's certainly bandied about. There are potential conflicts here. They may occur, they may not occur, but without I believe if this committee didn't do oversight hearings, it would be, you know, a dereliction of our duty.
But the Republican chair of the committee, Senator Orrin Hatch, denied the request for now.
I think it's a little premature for us to actually hold hearings on this subject, because the referral to the Justice Department was just recently made. And naturally, the department has to have some time to conduct an investigation. And personally, I think it would be imprudent for the Judiciary Committee to begin calling witnesses which may interfere with the investigation and prosecutors.
President Bush's spokesperson, Scott McClellan, said on Thursday that the White House had not received any subpoenas in the investigation and no staffers have been interviewed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich on Capitol Hill.
With the California recall vote coming to its final days this week, the largest get-out-the-vote efforts came from unions advocating to keep Gray Davis in office, the most active of which have predominantly immigrant membership. And as the immigrant worker freedom rides come to D.C., the issue of citizenship in order to vote has become one of the many issues that the riders will demand from Congress and the White House, as Selena Musuta reports.
On Wednesday afternoon, 900 immigrant freedom worker riders arrived at the Randall Recreation Center in Washington, D.C., and were greeted by the sounds of music and cheers from the D.C. Union, religious, and activist communities. For many of the riders who took time off from working at hotels, parking lots, nursing homes, factories, it was an 8-day-long journey. Mai Ko, a freedom rider from Seattle whose family was held in a Japanese internment camp during World War II, says we cannot let history repeat itself.
There was a United States commission that studied what happened to the Japanese Americans during World War II, and they concluded that there were three major reasons why this occurred. One was racism, and racism still exists alive and well in our country today. The second is hysteria from the crises, and we certainly have that situation post 9/11. And the third one was a lack of political leadership, and that's why we're here. We need our political leaders to stand up.
Later on that evening, riders and their allies gathered at Bible Way Temple Church to hear a series of speakers from Congressman John Lewis, a Georgia Democrat, to a mother whose son was killed while detained by the Bureau of Citizenship and Immigration Services. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, a non-voting delegate of the District of Columbia, describes to the audience the economic power they have to push Congress into recognizing their rights.
We invite immigrants to do the work of citizens and then deny them the pathway to citizenship. That's what justice means in the United States of America today. You must turn that completely around. Tell them that what would happen if you took your $130 billion that you contribute to the U.S. economy with you.
The riders continue Thursday with a day of lobbying and a series of solidarity actions for D.C.'s parking attendants and underpaid laundry workers. Esther Chavez, a rider from New Jersey, says the riders are taking their demands to the doors of Congress.
Those who are permanent residents to be able to come a U.S. citizen. Also that the family reunification, those persons need to be expedited and allow families to be together. And the third point is for workers to have the right to organize. And the fourth point is for the respect of human rights in this country.
One major obstacle that the Freedom Ride highlights is a federal law that prohibits states to provide in-state tuition to out-of-status immigrants. The riders are throwing their weight behind an initiative called the DREAM Act. Solange Batal, the lobbying coordinator of the Freedom Ride, says the DREAM Act is critical for immigrants.
The DREAM Act rewards hardworking students who came here through no fault of their own and are currently out of status. It would allow them to continue their educational dreams, to go on to college, and by doing so, they would be able to pay in-state tuition. It would also give them a pathway to legalization.
The Immigrant Worker Freedom Ride has announced Thursday to be a national call-in day to the White House and Congress to support the DREAM Act. If you would like to support immigrant rights, call the White House at 1-800-321-8268 and the Congress at 1-888-355-3588. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Selena Masuta.
Pakistanis are still debating the message that was delivered to them this past weekend, supposedly from Al-Qaeda, urging all Muslims in the country to overthrow President Musharraf, calling him an infidel. The audio tape aired on Qatar-based Arabic TV channel Al Jazeera, and it takes a snipe at Musharraf for his decision to send Pakistani troops to Iraq and to recognize the State of Israel, while calling upon the Pakistani army to topple its chief before he hands them over to Hindus or neighboring India and flees the country to enjoy his bank account. The call to arms by Al-Qaeda, if authentic, is timely considering the new UN resolution seeking a multinational force for Iraq, under whose auspices Musharraf says he will send troops to Iraq. Masroor Hussain reports from Islamabad.
The recorded message purportedly released by Al-Qaeda calling Pakistan's leader General Pervez Musharraf an infidel is the second in less than a month. Some analysts here say the jihadis or fighters see American forces stuck in Iraq as an opportunity of weakening an imperialist power. Barrister Zaid Said is an expert in international law.
General Musharraf is taking a lot of risk. Perhaps they are trying to preempt any Pakistani move to send forces to Iraq. And maybe this is the reason for the timing, because they have really made the call at a time when the government still has this issue on its table. And it's quite possible that the Al-Qaeda or other extreme elements may now be diverting their attention towards Iraq.
Some 24 Pakistani army men have been arrested by Pakistani military authorities for alleged links to Al-Qaeda. Four of them were captured inside Afghanistan by the American occupation forces. General Aziz Ahmed Khan, a close confidant of Musharraf and a critic of Pakistan's pro-American policies, will visit Washington early next month to address American concerns that the general is one of the masterminds behind Taliban and Al-Qaeda operations. Such incidents cast a shadow of doubt that Musharraf's military might may not fully support American President Bush's exported anti-terror agenda. Parvez Iqbal Chima heads Islamabad Policy Research Institute, an independent think tank focusing on Pakistan's foreign policy.
One must recognize the fact that
the structure of the Pakistan army is such that even a high-level official is really unable to make a dent in the policies until and unless the entire corps commanders evolve a certain policy. What I can concede is that there may be some elements somewhat sympathetic to the Taliban. In the tribal areas, there may be a sympathetic element, and they may have, in one form or the other, extended whatever cooperation they could.
Even as Pakistan's leadership fortifies its security in light of the latest Al-Qaeda tape, the majority of Pakistan's population continues to fight a losing battle with poverty. Naveed Ahmed runs a small music shop outside of Islamabad and says whether it is the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. or the Army General Headquarters in Islamabad, Pakistan's leadership is not taking care of the most urgent need of its people.
Frankly, all this war against terrorism has not given me anything except for a fear of terrorist attack and a very hostile environment for my children when they grow up. If you ask me, it's a fight between the mullahs, al-Qaeda, the army people, and America. Nothing to do with us. Now America says Pakistan is its ally because it needs our troops for Iraq. What is happening is that Pakistan is being slowly dragged into the conflict. Iraqi guerrillas will kill our troops in Iraq, and al-Qaeda will terrorize us here in Pakistan.
Latest information coming out of the tribal region of Waziristan, bordering Afghanistan, say that Pakistan's army has launched what is being called a clean-up operation against Taliban and al-Qaeda remnants, killing 12 Chechen fighters and arresting 10 others and seizing a cache of arms. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage and Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia, Christina Rocca, have postponed their scheduled visit to Pakistan. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussain in Islamabad.
When Canadian headlines screamed about the arrest of a suspected network of terrorist suspects in Toronto in August, the story was repeated around the world. But 6 weeks later, immigration and police authorities concede that there is no evidence that the men represent any threat to Canada's security. Community members allege racial and religious profiling, as Christian Schwartz reports from CKLN in Toronto.
And I start the story when I got arrested. 10 people came into my home. They broke down the door, right? Look at me. Do I look like a terrorist? 3 people are holding weapons on me. And when they took me from there, that person even did not let me wear the clothes. And he teased me. He said, when you will go back home, you will look nice in this dress. And shame on that person now. I'm in the dress now, and I'm here. Shame, shame.
That was Fahim Kayani at a rally on Saturday, just 1 hour after his release from jail. Kayani was one of 21 men arrested in August in Toronto by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Ministry of Citizenship and Immigration in a joint investigation called Project Thread. The men were accused of being involved in terrorist activity. Media speculated on plots to fly planes into a nearby nuclear power plant or the CN Tower. But now Project Thread is unraveling. Last week, 6 of the 21 men were released on bail, joining 3 others released earlier, as ministry lawyers acknowledged that security concerns had been dropped in the cases of others still in custody. How were 21 men, 20 from Pakistan and 1 from India, jailed for weeks without being charged with any crime? Lawyer Lonnie Goslin explains.
The only thing they have to prove, according to Section 58C of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, that the minister is taking reasonable steps to conduct an investigation into a reasonable suspicion that the person is somehow linked to terrorist activity.
Provisions for the detention of immigrants and refugees suspected of posing a threat to security are not new to Canadian immigration law, but they have rarely, if ever, been used on this scale in Canada. What then were the reasonable suspicions underlying Project Thread? A ministry backgrounder released to the public in August summarized the case but gave no evidence of actual terrorist activity. Rather, the backgrounder detailed possible cases of immigration fraud. It described the living conditions of some of the men who didn't have a lot of money, who shared apartments, and moved often. The backgrounder also highlighted the shared place of origin of most of the men, describing the Pakistani province of the Punjab as, quote, noted for Sunni Muslim fundamentalism, unquote. Tariq Fateh is Punjabi. He's a founding member of the Muslim Canadian Congress. He spoke at a rally on August 28th to denounce the arrests as racial and religious profiling.
If I understand the position of Canada's law enforcement agencies, Muslims, and particularly those from the wretched province of Punjab, are not allowed to photograph the CN Tower. Muslims, particularly Pakistanis, are not supposed to visit tourist spots or museums or any multi-storied building because the mere looking at these buildings instills fear and terror in the minds and hearts of these men in uniform.
While the allegations of terrorism have now been dropped, most of the men are still being prosecuted on alleged immigration violations and could be deported. Last week, community activists were joined by members of opposition parties in calling for the release of all the detainees and an inquiry into Project Thread. That demand was echoed by Fahim Kayani on his release.
They call our countries non-democratic countries. This is a democratic country. I would rather go back to my country, which is on.
Local activists and lawyers note that detention on the grounds of supposed security concerns is increasing internationally. And while they vow to keep up the pressure in Toronto, they also hope to contribute to a global network to defend human rights and civil liberties. From CKLN in Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
Last night, the remaining Washington, D.C. residents, who engaged yesterday in a sit-in at the Republican Representative Dennett Hastert's office, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, were released from jail. Almost 80 people engaged in civil disobedience to protest what they say is taxation without representation and a lack of budget autonomy for D.C. Ingrid Drake reports from the nation's capital on how this incident is an example of how the power struggle between D.C. residents and some members of Congress has been heating up over the last few weeks.
This is D.C. You might think that you own it, a piece of South Africa on the...
After United States senators received a steady stream of calls and visits from D.C. residents, the Republican leadership pulled the high-profile $13 million school voucher plan for D.C. from the Senate floor on Tuesday. Political observers say it was clear that Republicans could not secure the votes needed to pass the controversial school voucher measure. Bella Rosenberg of the American Federation of Teachers says private school vouchers lack political momentum.
In a Republican-controlled House, and we're talking about pretty much the right wing of the party, it only passed by one vote. That is absolutely stunning. Representatives here in Washington have been hearing from their constituents all over the country on this. And judging from what we've seen as well, our own polls and surveys, it's resoundingly against vouchers in the district. People understand that they don't necessarily work and that the only solution is to improve the public schools and invest in the public schools, and they are hurting for money.
It is likely the voucher bill would not have passed the House if D.C.'s non-voting delegate to the House of Representatives, Eleanor Holmes Norton, could vote. Norton, like most D.C. residents, does not support the push for vouchers and instead advocates for full funding for public education. While congressional action on vouchers is stalled in Congress, the federal government continues to influence local policymakers' positions on vouchers. Over the last year, chair of the school board, chair of the city council committee on education, and the mayor have changed their positions to support vouchers. Last week, D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams announced that he intends to convince the city council to give him full authority over the elected school board. Danielle Colbutt, an elementary school teacher in the D.C. public schools, says she does not trust the mayor will invest in education for all children.
The mayor, I think, has an agenda that promotes big business in this city, and it doesn't promote education. I feel like if you can pull funds together to entice Olympic committees and to get baseball teams here, you should be able to fully fund public schools. I feel like with the new move with vouchers, you're saying the public schools don't matter. You're not going to value the public schools.
We understand the struggle. We going to drop the bomb. This is D.C. You might think...
Over the last year, student-led campaigns have achieved concrete victories within the schools, including a district-wide sexual harassment policy and improvements on bathroom conditions. Tuesday was no exception, when at least 1,000 D.C. students walked out of school to demand full funding for their schools and were joined by several hundred teachers and other union members. This is how Chester Jackson, a student at Calvin Coolidge Senior High School, said he and his peers have been driven to walk out by horrible school conditions.
We won't have enough teachers here to help us succeed. They always argue and fuss with us about us not performing well, but they don't give us the proper materials in order for us to do so.
My name is Jasmine Drain. I'm 16 years old. A friend of mine, Darrell Walker, pointed out to me that we are 5 blocks away from the White House, but yet we are the poorest public school in the school system.
My name is Demario Green. I'm in the 11th grade. The district should improve the school by giving more student input and listening to the students as opposed to just making unilateral decisions.
This is D.C. You might think that you own it, a piece of South Africa.
Students and their allies are preparing for an inquiry into allegations of principals instructing police and security guards to threaten and intimidate students participating in the walkout. Voucher opponents expect the D.C. voucher bill to surface later this month as part of a broader omnibus spending bill. The public education proponents will continue their efforts to support the D.C. public schools. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C. Thanks to Selena Masuda, DJ U-Rock, and Head Rock for help on this report.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.